Tech Talk with Lee Stark.
Good morning, Lee Stark. How are you Sunday morning?
I'm okay, mate. Yourself?
Pretty good, mate. Can't complain. Got a couple of listener questions for you before we start with our topics. You're ready to go?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this comes from Krista. Krista says, I use Google Maps when in my car. I have it voice activated, so I don't have to touch it at all. She said, I can simply say in reference to, hey, Google, insert name, and it will call that person that's saved in my phone. It'll even ask which contact I have if I have more than one person with the same name. But, and here's the but, last week, both Google Maps and her phone had an update, and now they will not connect. She said, if I ask it to call someone, it will start giving me businesses with similar names or tell me that it couldn't find someone in my contacts by that name. She said, I've looked through Maps settings and cannot find where I fix this. Would it be with Google Maps or my phone? Her phone is a, she says, I have a nothing, N-O-T-H-I-N-G,
yep.
Series 1.
What is
a nothing?
A nothing is a fairly new brand of phone, actually. I've got one of them for review. I reviewed it a couple of weeks ago. It's a brand of phone that is unique. They're transparent. They actually, you can see through the phones themselves. Everything Nothing makes is basically see-through. And so the idea of a nothing is that you're getting nothing extra. You're getting just the phone itself. With no extra things added on. They're a unique brand. They definitely have a unique look to them. The Nothing Series 1 is an interesting device to have, because I actually wasn't sure many Australians had access to them. It sounds like it's a problem with the phone itself, not necessarily the app. I mean, this does sometimes happen. What I would suggest is actually, when you go into settings of the Nothing phone, so Nothing just runs Android, nothing really complex there, ironically. If you go into the settings of Google Maps and go into the settings and you look for the app itself, there should be a thing that says clear all defaults or words to that effect. I'm grabbing every Android phone on my desk right now to see if I can actually find something similar that shows that. And the reason why I'm saying that is a lot of apps sometimes have, when they do a change or when something happens in the background, they sometimes kind of break things in the process. Not every bug can be ironed out. And so if you look for the app that you have in there, there's a setting inside Android that says apps. If you actually scroll down to any app in there, you'll find that it has the option to sort of clear everything. You can disable it, you can force stop, and you can often clear it. If you click on storage of the app, it'll actually show you what's in there for caching, and you can clear the data and clear the cache. That will reset the app back to the beginning of what it is, even with the updates. That sounds like the solution I would use here. It's really difficult to diagnose without knowing what's going on. Nothing's phones don't always play exactly the way they should by the way Android works. They have extra things going on there. And as I said, the Series 1, I wasn't aware Australians had access to it, so it sounds like they probably bought it before Nothing officially arrived in Australia. That shouldn't matter as much, but it does sound like it's an incompatibility between Nothing's Android overlay and the Maps app, and I would just reset what's inside Google Maps to just see if it's a problem with the phone or the app itself.
Okay, that's from Krista. Thank you for that. I want to ask you about these app updates, because we get these app updates on our phones all the time, and you expect that they have gone in and they've worked hard and they've got everything right and there's a new update on the app. But why, if we have an update on Monday, do we invariably on a Wednesday or a Thursday get another app update when it's with bug fixes and all these sort of things? If you go in to read the information as to why it's updating, it'll invariably say bug fixes and tweaks. Why don't they get it right the first time?
It's difficult too, in fairness. I've released an app myself and I do the exact same thing. It's difficult to get every bug nailed at any given time. I mean, you should think of how many types of phones there are in the world. Even if you just take the iPhone world, there are at present a minimum of 13 different models that you can buy today. from, you know, and that doesn't include the many that are still technically in active use and still being updated around the world. So it also doesn't take into account different screen resolutions and sizes that they can all run. So there's such a massive amount of variability on different devices that it's next to impossible for every company to get it right the first time. There's just too much testing, too much requirement to get everything right. So what will typically happen is that an app developer will release an update, and then a whole bunch of people will report bugs, and anything that is breaking the experience or destroying it for everyone, you know, so notwithstanding, because they seem to be having the most problems at the moment, they'll typically go and fix those ones immediately and then release another one after it. Bug fixes are common and frequent because bugs are often difficult to diagnose across the swath of devices that are out there in the world. So developers typically do the best they can. It depends on how big their development size is. And anything that is basically breaking it, they're the ones to get fixed quickly. Sometimes it happens earlier than expected.
Thank you for that. Pam has a question for you. Pam says, I was listening earlier this week, and there was a caller that said you can get apps on your TV, like, is it Tubi, T-U-B-I, Tubi and Plex? That means I would be able to watch movies whenever I want. How do I get an app on my TV? Do I need to connect it to my phone and leave it plugged in? Do I need to connect my TV to the internet? How do I do that? A lot of questions there.
To get apps on your TV, you need to have an internet connection on your TV, flat out. That's how it works. You also need to have a TV that supports an operating system, which is, for the most part, any new TV bought in the past 5 years, many of them in the past 10 years, but not every one of them. The problem with the whole apps on TV thing is that depending on the TV you bought or even how it's supported, weirdly, they may not actually provide updates to the operating system. Panasonic is a perfect example of this. They don't release TVs in Australia anymore, but there are still plenty of Panasonic TVs in Australia, and their app environment was never fantastic. So you might have a perfectly wonderful Panasonic TV that you're using from a few years ago, but you can't get new apps on it. To answer your question, though, you definitely need internet access to your TV, and you don't necessarily need your phone for it. You just need possibly a device that does it. So a lot of people suggesting a Chromecast, which won't exist very soon, or an Amazon Fire TV stick, or an Apple TV, just an extra device that you plug in that becomes your new TV source, and you'll be able to use apps like Tubi, which does use free movie networks, or Plex, which can use free movie networks, but also uses the downloads that you might have in your home network or on a different drive somewhere in your home. There are apps like this that work, and obviously you can get other streaming apps on it, like Stan, Netflix, and so on and so on.
Just a question in reference to these apps on TVs. If you are, I'm thinking of one of the apps, one of the streaming services. Let's talk about Binge, for example. Mm-hmm. You've got three different levels of choice as to what you want to pay per month with Binge. There's a $10 level, which you have to watch the ads. There's an $18 level, which allows you not to watch ads, and you can have two screens, and then I think the top level is $22, and you can have four screens. The $10 one is just one screen. Does that mean one screen at once? What I mean, if you've got two TVs in your house, does that mean you're only allowed to watch Binge? That's the example we're using. You're only allowed to watch Binge on one of those two TVs?
Just concurrently. It's just about at the same time. So, yes, one at a time versus two or four at a time. And the logic is, if you're a family and you have something like a kid upstairs who's watching it on their tablet or might be watching it on their computer or something like that, then it's the one concurrent use versus two or four, yeah.
Are all streaming services going down this road?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, many of them always have, to be honest. So the whole concurrent use thing has kind of always been there. The more critical factor for most streaming services at the moment is the introduction of ads, because it started, like Amazon have done that with Prime, Binge obviously has that. Netflix started it a while ago, but they don't do it on their TV, on their kids' version. So if you subscribe to the basic plan with ads and you have a kids' account, they won't show ads on the kids' account, which is rather interesting to know. You can actually kind of evade it that way. But, yeah, the ads thing is becoming more common. The concurrent thing is pretty much consistent consistent with most of the streaming networks, provided you pay for them. And then there's the other factor, which is they're all cracking down now on sharing your account with other people. So if you have a family that shares your account, if you don't pay the extra tax, Netflix charges like $8 a month for you to share it with an extra account, which is like half the price of a standard Netflix account, they'll actually start tracking when you log in and if the device is connected to the same Wi-Fi network that everyone else is using. That's rather how they track whether you're actually sharing an account with someone else.
What if you have two homes? So you want to watch Netflix, that was the example you were using. You're at home A, and you want to watch Netflix at home A, and you move to home B, and you want to watch Netflix at home B, and you're not watching Netflix at home A. Can you do that or not?
So you can. Our understanding of how Netflix tracks it is that they do it within the space of a month. So provided you don't spend 2 months consistently at home B, you should be fine. But what will happen is it'll just log you out and you'll just log back in again. That's effectively how that system works.
So I just don't understand why, if you're happy to pay a subscription for a streaming service and you're using it in one location, but most homes these days have more than one TV in their house. There might be a TV in the lounge room, there might be a TV in the sunroom or, you know, the kitchen area, and there might be a TV in the bedroom. So there's three TVs. I mean, really, I suppose, will you watch three screens all at once? But there is a possibility you might be watching two screens at once. And if you don't pay the super duper dollar price, you're only allowed to watch one TV screen.
It's partly how they make their money. I mean, there are other factors to it. For instance, if you subscribe to Netflix, you also get access to games, and they're expanding that as well. The idea is to get you to pay more. It's not just about the TV screens that you get. Part of the whole extra super-duper packages is you get higher resolution, so you don't get 4K, for instance, or I think Dolby Atmos sound, unless you pay the more expensive one, whereas other options, I think Amazon and Disney, are beginning to split that way as well. The plan is to try and get you to spend more to get the most amount of quality, and that, in turn, parts the number of screens. I actually weirdly don't use it for the number of screens. I just use it for the high quality. I really don't care about running extra screens. We only have so many in the house. I'll just use them so I can get the high quality.
Okay, Ryan says, you mentioned last week, and you just mentioned again this morning, that Google is ending Chromecast. He said, I currently use one for my projector in the bedroom. What will happen? Will I need to find another product?
No, you can keep using Chromecast. So Google is ending Chromecast, as in it's not going to produce more of them. Chromecast will still exist. It will still, as far as we understand, Chromecast exists in a lot of new TVs. It's kind of built in. It also will exist in its upcoming device, the TV streamer, which is kind of like a slightly more expensive Google TV that kind of looks like, it's like a white wedge, to be honest. You stick it on your desk. It'll come in September. But old Google TVs and Chromecasts, old Chromecasts with Google TV, that sort of stuff, they'll keep working. They're totally fine. The frustrating part is Google's not going to sell them anymore. I think that was one of the stories I gave you this week.
It was,
Yeah. And so it's really frustrating. I've had a lot of chats with people about this, and a lot of people are equally frustrated, because for the longest time, in that first question, it was a perfect example. If you had a TV that wasn't, or second question rather, if you had a TV that wasn't smart, then you could easily upgrade it using a Chromecast for about $50. And Google is removing that now. And we know why. It's because the current Chromecasts don't technically support AI, and that's what Google's expanding into, so they're not going to necessarily support it for that reason anymore. So your old Chromecast, totally fine. All of my old Chromecasts are announced. I use one for a projector as well. I totally agree. But they'll keep working. You just won't be able to buy new ones basically past September.
So what are they replacing the Chromecast with?
It's a white box. So it's like a white flat device. It kind of looks like a wireless charger, if I'm completely honest, called the TV streamer. And it basically has Google TV. It still has Chromecast functionality in it, but it will cost more. Google hasn't told us in Australia what it will cost, but our expectation is somewhere between $149 and $200, simply based off what it costs overseas. That suggests that it's probably going to compete more with the Apple TV sort of thing, as opposed to just being the $50 device you can simply plug in.
So Amazon, you say here in your story, Amazon still makes something. Do they still make the Fire Stick, TV Stick?
Amazon makes Fire TV sticks, which start from about the $50, $60 mark. They're similar. They don't do Chromecast functionality directly, but they do have the apps. So if you're looking for a quick way to upgrade a TV and you can't find a Chromecast when they all run out, the Fire TV sticks support similar functionality. They support apps. They do a whole bunch of the extra apps that that person was talking about on the TV, and they're inexpensive. It's frustrating that Google is going this way because, as I said, the Chromecast was such a dependable item and an easy recommendation for so long, and now we're basically left with a few replacements that do the job okay, but don't do it as well as the Chromecast did.
Samsung is building, well, we know Samsung, obviously they build TVs, they build phones, they do all sorts of things. But apparently now they're going to be building batteries as well, and batteries that last for 1,000 kilometres per charge.
For a car, yeah, which is a pretty big deal. I mean, most cars don't actually get, well, I think my understanding is around the 600K mark is a maximum. So Samsung is actually has built one that will effectively go to 900 to 1,000 kilometres, and they're expected to be available in about 2 years' time, which is fantastic, or just probably by mid-2027, so 2.5 years. There's a more interesting generation of it that I'm kind of excited about, which is that it's a generation of EV battery which will allow you to charge the entire thing in the space of 9 minutes. They're not expected till 2029, but I guess what's exciting about that is instead of having to park your car by a fast charging station and still wait there for about 30 minutes to an hour, you'll just be able to get a coffee, charge it up, and then keep going, and I love that.
How can you charge your car in 9 minutes, but you can't charge your phone in 9 minutes?
Well, you can, actually. Fast charging in phones is getting a lot better. In fact, fast charging in watches is getting a lot better as well. You can actually get... So, weirdly enough, a lot of the phones we're testing on the Android side of things have these things called fast chargers, many in the box. Some of them are as fast as heavy as 65 watts, which is enough to charge a laptop. So, you can, in some phones right now, go from roughly zero to about 80 within the space of 20 to 30 minutes, depending on if you have a fast charger or not. You can't do it wirelessly. Wireless charging has limitations, but fast charging in phones, when it's wired, can do really heavy amounts of power. So, you can actually use phone chargers in Android devices to charge laptops, and they'll also charge phones really quickly.
You're saying Android, is that available as a fast charger that would charge an iPhone for people with iPhones in, say, 20 minutes?
So I don't know if all the Android ones will. You can, for instance, fast charge an iPhone using a Mac laptop charger. It won't do quite as fast a speed, but that's improving all the time. If you have something like a 30-watt or even a 90-watt charger, the more power you effectively have in your charger, the faster you can actually charge your phone, iPhones included. But they top out at a certain amount. So I think the amount at the moment is about 45 watts. So you're looking at basically, no one ever charges, keeps their phone at 0%. Just keep in mind that. But the idea is zero to about 80% can usually be about 30 to 40 minutes, and then topping it back over to that final 20%. That's the part that, from 80 to 100, that's the part that takes the most amount of time, typically because there's just more processing required at that point.
We were talking about Samsung making batteries for cars. Intel is going to be making computer chips for cars. Why would they be doing that? I suppose because they're going to make money out of it.
Yeah, there's that as well. But it's also for things people don't expect. So everyone, when I told them about this, says, oh, they're going to make games for cars. Probably not. You might be able to play games in cars when you're waiting. Chips can do a lot of things, but a lot of the graphics chips that exist have more power than computer chips, people don't realize, a CPU versus a GPU. And the reason why this is interesting is because the more cameras you throw into a car, like for tracking, for making sure your car doesn't hit things, or even just reverse parking, the more they need to be controlled by a really capable processor. And in this instance, it looks like Intel is using a GPU, a graphics chip, to do that sort of thing. So it'll be used for camera control, it'll likely be used for AI, anything that we're not thinking about using our car for now, even just controlling dashboards. The current swath of chips in phones can actually do a lot. They can control massive cameras as on the whole, but that's what they'll be used for, to control all the extra things that you're not thinking about inside of a car.
Mate, last but not least today, we're talking about AI. We seem to talk about AI, artificial intelligence, all the time. AI for dentistry work, a robot putting a crown on your tooth?
Yeah, so this is intriguing. It's a company that's produced a robot that actually replaces what a human does in a dental lab. It's kind of the stuff of nightmare fuel, but it is intriguing all the same. It's kind of a taste of probably where things, taste pun intended, you know, of where things are going in the next decade or so. Effectively, a company produced a robot that would prepare a tooth for a crown, which is a process that normally takes 2 1-hour sessions, and they did it in the space of 15 minutes, the robot. The robot takes a 3D scan, or basically understands your tooth with a 3D model, and then goes to work. So it does it all in 15 minutes. The catch is that you can't really talk to the robot as it's happening. You kind of just have to grin and bear it, so to speak, and it'll be done. It'll be done quickly, but as I said, it's stuff of nightmare fuel, because while you get your tooth worked on, I don't know if you can say to the dentist or the robot dentist at that time, please, this hurts. It's different from dealing with a human. However, it is a product that's coming. It'll be up to dentists to actually try it out. I don't think Australians are going to see it for quite some time, but if you hear from your dentist in the next few years that there's an AI that can work on your teeth, this is what it is.
Yeah, it'll happen. You can bet your bottom dollar. It'll happen. Mate, always good to catch up with you. Thank you for spending some time with us again this Sunday. We look forward to talking to you next week.
No worries. Happy to help.
See you, mate. Bye-bye. And that's Lee Stark, our tech guy, tech guru. If you've got any questions for Lee, you can do one of two things. Send your question to me via email and we'll put it to Lee next week. Or you can go on to Lee's website and he's got an email address there. You could send him the question and tell him you listen to us here on a Sunday morning and he'll reply to you. His website is picker.com.au. That's P-I-C-K-R.com.au.